Well, today we have not one, but two comic book legends with us. First, we have artist-writer Matt Wagner, creator of such legendary characters as Grendel, Mage, and the author of one of my personal favorite series, Sandman Mystery Theater. We also have artist Kelly Jones, legendary for his work on Batman, and one of, if not the best artist, I'm sorry, Matt, to ever draw the Sandman.
Well, I'll take that one because it's true.
But today,
and actually, that's how Kelly and I met, because we both drew. He drew the bulk of Seasons of the Mist, which is the most famous Sandman story arc. I drew one chapter in that, and so we were both together with a lot of the PR tour stuff, and that's how we first met.
Yeah, Matt, I mean, you, Al, you co-created Dead Boy Detectives, you know, right? Like, I mean,
okay,
that was...
yeah, I don't take much credit for that, because again, it was just that one issue. They weren't detectives yet.
They were just
a couple of ghosty high school kids, you know.
So you created the Dead Boy part.
Yeah, there you go, the Dead Boy part, not the detective part. Yeah,
I always like a good guy who creates dead boys. It's good for our show. It really helps. I'm glad it's a good interview again.
And I will say, you know, DC, the way they credit you is whoever drew it first, they get the credit.
Yeah. Right.
And I don't feel like I deserve it because I didn't do them as those characters, as the detectives. And yet when they had that one season of the show, I got a bit of money out of it, you know, and I was just like, okay. I mean, it wasn't, you know, I didn't quit my job, but.
Amen. Get that money, dude.
Yeah.
No, I've created about a half dozen characters I had no idea I created. And he's right. I looked and I said, I don't even know who this is. And they say you did it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, that both of you have just, you know, drawn and written so much over the years. Like, do you sometimes just forget things that you've done?
Sometimes, yeah. Details more than, you know, whole movements or anything like that. But, yeah, it takes, you know, for instance, I know George R.R. Martin has a dude that helps him keep track of everything in Westeros because he's lost track of all that shit, you know.
Yeah.
But, yeah, no, just little things here and there. But, no, for the most part, I can keep track of it pretty well.
Maybe you could finish that.
You're busy on something else right now.
Oh, I mean, before we get to your current project, I do have to bring up something that Kelly, you may have forgotten that you did way back in the day.
I'm sure I did.
But it was I realized this morning when I was looking at the books that you've done over the years, I realized that you were the very first artist to really have an effect on me as a child. The first comic book to really have like a huge effect on me, Dino Riders.
Yeah. I still have the toys.
Really?
Yeah. I was under contract with Marvel then. And because I had started on the Micronauts, they simply just assumed you do licensing.
Yeah.
So I didn't get a say in it. And one day I got this gigantic box of toys and I had no idea why. And it said from Marvel, right? It came from Marvel. I had no idea what it was. And then they get a hold of me and said about a day or so later. So I have no clue. And they said, you have been assigned this. The scripts are being written, blah, blah, blah. And when you're under contract, you have no say.
Yeah.
And
that sucks ass.
Yeah, oh, it did. It did, because you don't get a say. And I when I was on Micronauts, though it was licensed, you can invent stuff and you could make up things. And they didn't care because the toys they quit making. These went through like layers of people to approve one page. So I quit, but I didn't tell them I'm quitting. I just accepted a job from DC, and I just said, okay, whatever they do, you know, they can.
And it wasn't worth pursuing you over.
I can't, because I can't get through this.
Yeah.
And one of the great moments of my career, besides working with Matt, was this went on for about 2 or 3 months. I drew a few and then I just couldn't deal with this anymore. But I went over to DC. Well, in that time, I'm wondering, when are they going to call and say, where's the art? You know, I was completely unprofessional. But I was so angry because I kept saying, get me off, and they wouldn't do it. Take me off this thing. And then I find out that they had canceled all the license books. And because of that, they owed me a lot of money. I had signed this contract. So I get this very large check, larger than I would have gotten from anything they did.
Amen.
And I was still, and I was working on Dead Man. So it was like one of those, you know, I made the right decision for all the, you know, I did it. I should have said, I'm just quitting, but they wouldn't take no for an answer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because nobody wanted to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? So we got this guy yoked in.
Right. And so I remember everyone saying, God, you really changed. And I go, no, I never got to be there. You know, you didn't get to be who you were. So, you know, it was one of those good things because Dead Man turned everything around. But I owe it to Air Raiders. And I owe it to Dino Riders. I owe it to those guys.
That's like getting an inheritance from a relative you didn't know existed.
I felt like Jed Clampett. I oiled people.
But hey, you know, whether you really cared about it or not, like that art, like it truly disturbed me when I was a kid. Like
the one professional part was I put everything I could into it.
Yeah, you did.
Because I realized, this isn't the fans' fault. This is me and an editor and the company. Mm-hmm. So you always put your all into something, as ludicrous as it was. And I'll be honest with you, I don't have bad feelings about it because I have an enormous amount of people love those books.
Yeah.
I get offers because I just put the original art in a box and said, who's going to want it? Everybody wants it. I mean, it is one of the most requested thing are those two licensed books.
Micronauts and Dino Riders.
It was designed for kids. So I got to remember, what was I into as a kid? Well, I would love it too. Whatever those things were, you know. It's one of the reasons.
Was it? I don't know, Dino Riders. Was it gruesome? Did you make it gruesome?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. That's what disturbed me because I was like six and it's like, oh, here's a guy. Like I remember someone getting eaten by a dinosaur.
Yes,
I think.
That was me. I finally do things because you do things to get fired.
Yeah. Well, that seriously, that your attempt to get fired changed my entire life.
Yeah.
But like that was my first introduction to like gore, to horror, all kinds of stuff.
The visual idea is great. Like weapons on dinosaurs and guys fighting. Well, yeah. Okay. That's
what
cool.
Else do you need?
But then they wouldn't go as far as they should. So I went as far as I could. And I started doing a thing where I turn in everything really late so they had to approve it. Mm-hmm. So you got people getting eaten and killed and whatever. And I got a lot of pushback on it. And then, like I said, when you're doing stuff and you're trying to bring that extra whatever and you're getting – that's where you're getting shit on. You just – all right, fine. I'm out of here. And then I watch – because I watch all my goofy friend artists and they were pulling stunts all the time and would still get work.
Yeah.
So I thought, this will be my one time. I'll change it and I'll do this stuff. And what's good is it carried over to Dead Man because I was so angry at that time. I said – they said, well, you know, Neil Adams, Dead Man. And so I just said, no, my version, and fire me then. I had a bad fire me point of my career. And that's
like early in the Vertigo days, we weren't allowed to say the word fuck.
Yeah.
You know, even though it was supposedly adult aimed comics, we weren't allowed to say fuck. So Neil Gaiman and I used to talk about how if you had something questionable you wanted to get through, you would throw a fuck or two into the script.
Yeah.
And then that's all they would focus on. You got to take that fuck out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Everything else good? Yeah, fine.
What are the dirty words for comics? Like, is there a list? Is there a George Carlin 7 dirty words or is it just fuck?
No, I'm sure, you know, cunt and shit and piss and all that. You're talking about mainstream comics. Like I've always done indie comics. I've done some mainstream stuff, but Jesus Christ, man, my stuff's foul.
Yeah.
You should read his scripts because in his scripts, he's really foul in describing what he wants. And I'm like going, this is wonderful. Matt finds 14th century curse words. And I'm like, that's just wonderful.
Well, speaking of 14th century curse words, the reason why that we brought the two of you in today is to discuss your incredibly innovative new take on everyone's favorite Eastern European warlord, Dracula.
Dracula.
I mean, your take on Dracula, it's one of those ideas that you can't believe you've never seen it before.
Yeah, no
you can't
shit,
believe
right?
That you
yeah.
can't believe that no one's ever done this. Yeah. Is that y'all are telling the story of Dracula from the perspective of Dracula.
Yeah.
And it's one of those ideas, I told my wife about it. She's like, oh my God, I've always wanted to hear that. She's a massive fan of the Bram Stoker book. But it just, for some reason, never occurred to people to just tell the story from Dracula.
So this is something I've been stewing on for, I want to say more than a decade. I always wanted to try my hand at Dracula. But what do you do? It's been done to death, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, the original novel is what's described as epistolary, which means it's told in the form of, there's no omniscient narrator. Letters, journals, news articles, and the one voice missing is Dracula. And, you know, it works in the original novel because it makes him a sinister kind of other, a presence, you know. But after this long, we deserve to hear his point of view, right? You know? So I finally realized what we need to do is not adapt the novel. We need to tell everything else that the novel only hints at and doesn't tell. Like, for instance, book one, which is called The Impaler, twice in the original novel, Van Helsing mentions that when he was alive, Dracula attended something called the Scholomance, which is an Eastern European legend about this seminary for the dark arts that Satan himself hosts way up in the mountains. And it's a 7-year tenure, and he takes 10 students every time, every tenure, and then at the end of that, he keeps one of them. And I thought, how could they have fucking done anything with this before? This is such a deep well of story to be told, you know? And so that was our beginning, you know. And then the second one's called The Brides because the three vampiric women make this indelible appearance in the novel, and they're only there for 3 pages. And I was like, well, we got to hear their story too. We got to hear how he got each one of them and who they were before they became his brides, you know. And the new one we're getting ready to launch in just a few days, the Kickstarter. We do all these as Kickstarter campaigns.
Nice.
And the new one, any fan of the novel knows that once the action shifts from his castle in Transylvania to the streets of London, Victorian London, he's off stage for the rest of the novel. Yeah. He's just this shadowy presence, you know. You get some reports of things he's done, but nothing first-person account, right? And so we're showing you what he's doing because he's obviously doing something the whole time he's there, you know. And you get to see everything that he does. And it's been a blast. And you know, I keep writing these sequences thinking to myself, oh, Kelly's going to fucking nail this. It's going to be so awesome. And then he turns in the art and it's like better than I could have imagined it to be, you know. And I'm an artist too, so I've imagined quite a bit. And, you know, it's such a beautiful synthesis between the two of us.
I liked your reaction, Marcus, to when you were saying how did no one think of this? Because when Matt called me about, do you really want to work together? Because we'd known each other for so long and we'd always done this little two-step about working together. And when he told me the idea, I reacted exactly the same way. And he would just throw out the thing with the Scholomance, or he would just throw out what are the backstories of the brides? And then when he told me the third one wouldn't be an adaptation of what we know, but a exploration of what he was up to, I was reacting the same way. And when that happens to you, I give Matt all the credit for this because he had to do all the research. It was his idea. In the 120 plus years of Dracula, no one's done this. And it was completely interesting to me because when he first said Dracula, I said, well, what are we going to do with this? And then he tells me this. And so in 3 minutes, I went from Dracula to when do we fucking start?
Yeah.
So how much of this, because I never knew about Satan and Dracula being buddies, you know, like
that
was like,
and reread it, and he was right. There's the Dracula, the devil teach. I'm like, where did I miss that?
Yeah. I completely went over it, like skimmed over that as well.
Yeah. And so how much of this is your own creative license and how much of this is like strictly is like come straight from?
Well, we are trying to stick religiously to the canon of the text. Okay. And yet, as I said, so much of it is only kind of this vague hints, you know, of he mentions the Scholomance. He doesn't say what went on there, you know, but I took that opportunity to I felt also an important impetus to have a very special way for him to become a vampire, because I figured, you know, he's the OG vampire. He's the name, you know, I maintain he's the most famous literary character of all time. There's almost nowhere in the world you can say the name Dracula and people don't know who the fuck you're talking about.
Well,
you know?
God's pretty big.
Yeah, God's pretty big too, yeah. We're talking about fictional characters, yes, God's pretty big. But I thought, well, he's got a very special way to become a vampire. He can't just get bitten by another vampire. That's how every other fucking vampire becomes a vampire. Therefore, that's boring. So, yeah. Had to come up with a very special way for him to become a vampire, which we see in book one, you know. And the rest of it, you know, like, Ed, you're asking how much of it's from the canon. So, regardless of its, you know, I wouldn't say Dracula's considered by a lot of literary scholars as, you know, not on the level of Dickens or Tolstoy or, you know, these highbrow writers, it's considered kind of a pulp thing.
Yeah.
And yet it is one of the most dissected and annotated fucking books in the English language ever. I have like four different annotated versions. When I was writing this third one, I was working off a calendar. Again, since it's told in the form of letters and journals, they're all dated. So I had a calendar based upon the original text of what happens every goddamn day.
Yeah.
And I had to make it fit all that. This thing even had the sunrise and sunset times and the phases of the moon.
It's incredible.
That's awesome.
So I had to appeal and make sure I passed the sniff test for all the Dracula scholars. Yet I also had to make it so that if you've never read the book, you would still be interested in the story as it unfolds. You know, so yeah. The third one was pretty intense. In a way, the third one's what we've been working for. Yeah. Since the beginning. So
I just had to worry about how much breasts and blood to put in. So
speaking of breasts and blood, I actually do have a question for you. Cause Kelly, I mean, your horror stuff is just incredible. Like the way that you draw pain and anguish in a way that's just so evocative, but your gore is just off the charts. What's your favorite piece of gore to draw? It's like, this is like the James Lipton, like, what's your favorite word? Like, what's your favorite gore?
I think my favorite gore, if I'm to be perfectly honest, are the little things. It's the little things that look painful.
Yeah.
It can be a small thing, like a needle in a finger or something where I can do that. Because I think everyone can relate to that kind of pain, to those kind of those little moments.
In the second book, there's a scene where the villagers storm the castle and Dracula drives them away by commanding lightning and then summoning rats and bats. And there's a scene where a bat is clinging to a woman's face and plucking out her eyeball with its teeth. And I remember thinking, oh, wow, that looks painful. Yeah. Yeah.
but horror has totally different tropes and shtick than superhero.
Yeah.
So I try to take advantage of that as much as I can. And Matt, and it's all characterization. It's more characterization. And Matt will do a thing where he, in why the books are so entertaining to draw is he does sequences all through it, scenes. And they all stitch together. But it's like you'll get a 6 to 10 page sequence, maybe. And within that, he gives you something. And so you get to build that atmosphere for that one shot or that one moment. And I think that's what makes people react even stronger to it than if I just drew an axe murder going on. And it's, you know, this wonderful grotesqueness that Matt will write, where it's unapologetic, non-biased. There it is. And then we move on. So it isn't like, you know, you're getting off on it. It's like you go, oh, that's disgusting, or that's frightening, or that's horrible, or that, more importantly, painful.
Yeah, I mean, I had the reaction of, damn, quite a bit.
Matt does
when I was reading. Damn.
Yeah, Matt will do casual things. Like, he casually is, you know, there's this corrupt politician in the second one, and he gives Dracula this boy. And Matt just has him casually carry off the boy, but they're discussing things the whole time. And that really bothered me,
yeah.
You know, but I thought, yeah, that's cool. I mean, at the same time, you're going, Matt, kind of, it's like a psychological test. How disturbed are you? Because you find yourself enjoying it and then saying, why am I enjoying this? This horrible mayhem going on. But I do, because Matt Everything's driven by character, so you feel a lot, feel it much, much more.
Yeah, that's very important, especially with a contemporary vampire story, because again, vampires have been done to death.
Yeah,
and you have to do something to make people care, even just in passing, about what's happening to these characters. You know.
Yeah, I mean, as far as the characterization of Dracula goes, like once you started like fleshing out this character that has not over the years been fleshed out all that much. I mean, the most might be, you know, might be Francis Ford Coppola like giving him a romantic backstory. But when
Which
you're
is
fleshing
not
out
there in the fucking book,
not at all, not even close. Yeah, this weird muscle armor. Was there anything that you discovered about the character of Dracula that sort of surprised you?
Well, yeah, in that, so you have to keep him as this unrepentant villain, you know? Yeah. He doesn't, and also there's nothing romantic about him, you know? That, again, as I said, in the Coppola, I have this love-hate relationship with the Coppola movie because I adore the cinema of it. His filmmaking in that is fucking brilliant, top to bottom.
Yeah, and you can't argue with Tom Waits as Renfield.
Well, no, I don't like the casting much, kind of top to bottom.
Oh, okay.
I think the casting's kind of all bad. I'll get back to that in a second. But the whole love story thing, just, you know, once he gets to London and gets hooked up with Mina, he turns into this fucking fop for the most part. You know, there's the scene where she's been fooling around with him, and then Jonathan gets rediscovered and she rushes to his side to marry him. And they have this sequence of Dracula, you know, weeping copiously and smashing things. All right. Dracula does not fucking weep ever. And so, you know, I just had to maintain that, you know, he's not full of remorse. He doesn't have any remorse. There's one little bit of remorse he shows at one point in one of the books. But one thing I did find interesting is that he has these three brides that is in book two. And I also had to be careful to not contemporize that. Yeah. You know, he would not think of them as equals at all. That whole concept, that modern day concept of marriage and relationships, not there at all. And yet, these are the first, he never had any children with his living wives. These are the first things he's ever created as opposed to destroyed. So he feels some sense of responsibility for them. He feels a need to provide for them. He goes without eating himself to provide food for them, to provide blood for them. So that was and I wouldn't even call that a moment of humanity. It's almost more of his megalomaniacal sense in that, you know, I did this, I have to maintain this. This is part of my, these are my conquests. I can't let them go. I can't let them wither, you know?
No, the characterization that I loved is why he chose them. That was the thing that got me, was each one, he can have anyone I guess he wants. So when I was reading this, I thought, oh, this is interesting, because as he chooses each one of the girls, it's why he would, it's what interests him. So you get something from Dracula. Never thinks he's evil. He never thinks, "Oh, I'm evil." He's doing what he does, and his
he knows he strikes terror, though. That's slightly different. Yeah,
but he did that as a warlord.
Yeah, right.
So that to me was cool. So when you get the other side of like, why would he be with each one of these girls? What is that's fascinating. It's horrific. It's
for three different reasons, because they're each three very distinct women.
That complexity of the brides, as well as him, I always describe Matt as literary pulp, and that's it. It's like, boy, you don't need that. But when you get it, you're saying, how can you read this without that? That's so much grist for me.
Another cool thing about the brides is once he gets each of them, one of the things that first attracted each of them to him, they kind of lose that when they catch his contagion, right?
Yeah.
his gift destroys part of what he liked about them to begin with, you know?
Yeah.
Of course. So, I mean, so Matt, you know, you're kind of, I guess, you know how to do an anti-hero. Like that like you absolutely know how to do that. So what is it that you think we gain from hearing stories from the perspectives of villains, like the direct perspective of a villain?
Because we each have a villain inside of us, baby. You know what I mean? You recognize it. You recognize God, but there for the grace of God go I, you know? I mean, when somebody's behaving like an absolute fucking shit, you think to those times in your life when you behaved like an absolute fucking shit. And it might have not been for the same reasons or in the same manner, But you know, there's a famous quote from Marcel Proust that he never heard of a crime committed by man that he didn't imagine himself fully capable of doing.
Hmm.
And, you know, that's what I love about antiheroes, you know, and just that they're so unrepentant, you know, and so, you know, we have enough redemption stories. Fuck that.
Yeah, it was crazy reading it because, you know, Dracula is a bad guy. He's like the most notorious bad guy in the world. But, you know, I'm reading this thing. I'm like, you know, I get it. I like it.
Yeah. Well, I can point you to another very famous example of that. Hannibal fucking Lecter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Exactly. He's horrible. And yet all through Signs of the Lambs, you're like, he's got to get out of there. Yeah. I can't wait to see how he gets out of there. And at the end, when he calls her and he's going to go eat that dude, you're like, yeah, get that. The fucking dude needs it. You know?
Yeah. What I found interesting about it is, I don't know if this was Kelly or you, Matt, because Vlad the Impaler, you know, I'm also like very, like, I'm not a huge Dracula nerd like everyone else in this room. And
like I obviously am. Yeah.
But Vlad the Impaler, I always thought he used heads, not like
no, it's body. Full bodies, baby. Woo! Up the poop chute for the most part, or the vagina.
That was
that's historically accurate. That's also
terribly excruciating about it is the weight of your body would slowly pull you down, and that would like dig its way up through your innards, you know. Wow. Horrific way to die.
They head on a pike. That's like that everyone did head on a pike.
Yeah.
Like that was standard for the time. Yeah.
You're already literally dead when they put your head on a pike. You know what I mean? The head's come off already, right? impalement's a just awful way to go.
I mean, so this Dracula, I mean, this is a monstrous Dracula. This is not a romantic or a sexy vampire. But you know, vampires have over the years kind of gone more towards that area, more towards like a bit softer, a bit sexier.
Well,
like,
sure, with Anne Rice and the Twilight shit, you know.
Sure. Yeah.
You look at something like Robert Eggers' version of Nosferatu, you know, which really pulled it back to being this foul, disgusting creature, you know.
It was very cool. Only other time I've seen the beard and the mustache than you guys. Is that accurate to
That's accurate, yeah. He wears a mustache to basically hide his teeth. Yeah, he's not. He can't retract the fangs like so many modern cinematic interpretations.
Yeah, what did you think of Asthmatic Nosferatu?
Oh, I loved it. Now you know it. I've loved every Kelly too. We've talked about this extensively. We love every version of that film. You know the Murnau version, the Herzog version, and the Eggers version.
Yeah.
Now that said,
Vlad the Impaler.
That is not Dracula, you know?
No, that's
not Dracula. Dracula is a different character. Dracula is not a decaying corpse. He's also much more courtly than that. The thick Romanian accent, you know, that's not in the book at all. That Harker comments to him, he's trying real hard to perfect his English so he can fit in and not attract attention when he's in England. And Harker comments to him twice, oh, you speak great English. You don't have any accent at all. Yeah. You know, the accent we're so familiar with comes from the Bela Lugosi film version. Lugosi was Romanian and spoke almost no English, so he had to learn his lines phonetically. So that accent became the, you know, default Dracula accent, but again, not in the book.
Yeah. So besides Dracula, what other vampires do you love? And Nosferatu, of course.
Oh, Kel, you got any that you want to jump in there with?
I really like Count Yorga.
Yeah.
I dig him quite a bit. I think there's little touches they did that I always liked that he knows all these languages. So when a deaf person comes up, he communicates in sign. And I thought, that's nice. Yeah. That was pretty good. And he's sadistic in it.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course.
There's a lot of good film versions. I've gone through a lot of film versions. First of all, both the book and the film of Let the Right One In are some of my favorite things ever. You know, you know, that the film, you know, to my mind, the best horror is always about something else other than the scares, you know?
Yeah.
You know, Rosemary's Baby is about fear of pregnancy, you know, and Let the Right One In is about loneliness. You know, it's about the loneliness of being a bullied 12-year-old boy or a 200-year-old vampire, you know? And that one is just so poignant and so delicate at the same time as being scary as shit, you know. I'm reading a new one right now by a new horror author. Well, no, he's not that new, but a guy I really like named Keith Rosin, who lives here in Portland. And his brand new book's called Coffin Moon, and it's a vampire book. I'm about halfway through it. It's terrific. There's a Native American writer named Stephen Graham Jones. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him.
He was my creative writing professor in college.
No shit! Wow!
Yeah,
no,
wow. Yeah, I actually...
Amazing. All fucking world, man.
I actually used to lend him comics when I was in college. Like, I lent him, like, my entire run of the Max.
Oh, cool.
Yeah,
cool.
And he's like, yeah. He once showed up to my house at 8 a.m. to return them on a Saturday after I was extraordinarily hungover.
How did he like Dino Riders?
His most recent book's called The Buffalo Hunter Hunter. It's about a Native American vampire, and it's terrific. It's
I gotta read
really,
it.
Really great. There was a just a number of years ago called Bite Marks. You remember that one, Kelly? I turned you onto that one.
Yeah, that was a good one.
That one's rough, man. Yeah, some rough shit in it.
At the risk of you guys talking shit about something that could, you know, make you upset, how do you feel about Blade?
Oh, love Blade. Yeah,
love Blade.
Yeah, Blade's great. Blade's great.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Blade. And I'm totally remiss for not mentioning Sinners. Holy fucking shit!
Yeah. Sinners was incredible.
Sinners is like Dusk to Dawn done right.
Classy from Dusk to Dawn is how I've already. Yeah.
Blade, you know, Blade uses one thing I want to point out is, you know, the whole that seems to run through almost every vampire myth is the whole sunlight destroys a vampire. Again, not so in Dracula, not so in the book. I don't know how well you remember the Coppola movie. In the book, he can walk around during daylight hours. He's just not as powerful.
Yeah.
He gets his full vampiric powers at night. And he has to sleep during the day on a bed of his own soil to fully recharge his powers. But if you recall the Coppola movie, when he first meets Mina, it's on the streets of London during broad daylight.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Blade is just full of those, you know, just vampires bursting into dust and flame. Just awesome.
I love it.
Like a lot of franchises, though, it went downhill fast, you know. Yeah. Number one and two were great.
I don't know. One of my favorite things to see is to watch a vampire explode. That's going to make me happy every single time if a vampire explodes for whatever reason.
Great scene of that in Let the Right One In, where the one guy's girlfriend gets bitten and she's turning and she asks the hospital attendant to open the window because she knows that will destroy her. And she just bursts into this ball of flame that's like licking the ceiling immediately, you know?
Yeah.
You know what one isn't good, but I love it anyway? John Carpenter's Vampires.
Yeah.
Which one? Yeah,
John Carpenter's Vampires.
Yeah, like, I'm not
it's
nuts
a bad
about that
movie.
One.
It's a bad movie. I know it's a bad movie, but I'll put it on anytime.
I can appreciate that, Ed. I can totally appreciate that. Being a Carpenter, we just got a quote, a blurb from Carpenter, an endorsement.
Really?
Yeah.
Why take it back then?
Thank Mr. Jones for that one.
No, I mean, the blurbs that y'all have been getting for this book, I mean, I'm not alone in saying that this book is incredible. I mean, the reaction that y'all have got from this, like, how does it feel to have so many people just say, like, holy shit, this is the Dracula story that I've been waiting to hear, to read my entire life?
Well, it makes me feel like, wow, woo, we got it right. Yeah. Because, of course, you never know going into it, you know, you might hit a lot of resistance, but I don't know. This from the very beginning, as Kelly said, when I first started outlining to him what I wanted to do and I was seeing his reaction, I was like, yeah, we're really on to something here. Yeah. You know, it's working, you know.
I couldn't tell anybody. I mean, I would read this. He would tell me this. I didn't want it out there. And so I was alone with this for a long time.
We sat on it for a while. Yeah.
And it was driving me crazy because I knew how I was reacting. So when I started hearing other people, when they would read the first one or whatever and react the exact same way, then I knew I always knew Matt was onto something, because I know this stuff pretty well. And I felt stupid when he was telling me this stuff. Why didn't I think of this? And then very entertained when I would read it. How do you sustain this idea? And when he said, well, in the first one, which is I think a great how he got there, and he really doesn't become a vampire till the very end.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It sustained interest.
Yeah, at the same time, we had to make him very recognizable as Dracula.
In lesser hands, what Matt wrote would be dreadfully boring. it would be. And I always told him, I said, this would be great if someone drew it in stick figures, because it's just all there. Mm-hmm. And it's the ideas. I'm very big on ideas. I think ideas, if you've got those, that really is compelling to people. And Matt had ideas everywhere on this. I mean, just from just how you do a good comic book to what you're going to say to bringing a new light on something. All of it was working. All of it. And it is all I can do. I mean, people will say to me, you know, how you go about sustaining that energy. It's very easy. I mean, like I said, he writes all these scenes, which for me, I like, because people, when they like something, they'll describe something they like. And I found this happens to me the most with what Matt's done. They tell me so much from both the first books.
Yeah.
They'll just go on and on and on about, and this scene, and this scene, and this scene. And I'm going, well, that's what I thought. That's why I'm not, you know, I'm like, and a lot of stuff too will just pop up. I mean, there's things, I don't pre-plan anything. I don't do thumbnails. I don't do anything. I work very emotionally. So I want to feel it that day. I'll read Matt's stuff over a lot. And sometimes I'll get an idea, but most of the time that idea is rejected by the time I get to actually drawing it. And then I always think, well, how can I really emphasize what Matt's doing here? And that's where it comes together really well, because I don't know that a lot of this stuff's going to happen. Some stuff I think is going to be really gory isn't, and other stuff becomes very gory and I didn't think of it that way. But that's the pleasure of working with someone who's figured it out. There's no plot holes with Matt. I don't understand this. So at that point, you kind of bend the knee, because you realize somebody put a lot of effort, thinking, research to scare the hell out of you. And it works. That he does do that. I'll read it and go, Jesus Christ.
Even down to, fellas, you have a copy of the first volume sitting in front of you there.
Yeah.
The logo we use is the same logo that was on the very first 1897 hardcover edition.
Nice.
Hell yeah. That's great.
Keeping it real.
Now, if this is too much of a spoiler for the first book, please tell us to not put it in the episode. But I'm curious. Why was Satan a boy?
Just because it's the opposite of what you expect.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
And he looks.
I mean, you get to see what he really is later.
Yeah.
You
know? Yeah. And he presents himself differently to everybody.
Yeah. There's that one scene where all the various scholars, depending on their nationality, are describing how they see him. And it's all basically derivative of their own mythologies, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So what was it about, like, the Eastern European mythology, like Dracula's mythology, that made him see Satan as a
It's Catholic based, you know, and I'm sure in my mind it was some little boy that he had fucking impaled.
Yeah.
Some peasant boy, you know?
Yeah. That was one of the things the first time
Dracula's response is, I don't give a shit.
Like, Satan tried to freak me up. Fuck you, Satan.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I was there. I saw that thing go up his asshole.
Yeah, because right up top, when you see the impaled people, when he's still Vlad and he's still in charge and shit, you see a little boy.
That's what I thought when I read it. That's why I put the little boy there. I didn't think it would be that, but I thought that's what Matt was thinking, was this is somebody, or a presentation of somebody he did this to.
Yeah, this is not endemic to that time period. Yeah. I mean, look at the casualties in Gaza.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. I mean, or it's indiscriminate of age and class and sex and everything. You know, war destroys everything.
Any war. Yeah, any war is like that. And considering that Vlad doesn't see himself as a sick guy, but using that as a psychological terror weapon, which worked in real life, it worked. It's a means to his end. So he's not even thinking about, I really shouldn't have done that. That's really- he's thinking, man, those shrieks will keep the Turks away.
Yeah.
And then in book two, we had a sequence where, So in the actual novel, You only ever see him prey on women, right? You get the feeling that, sure, he bites guys, but you only ever see him prey on women. And if you go down the Anne Rice route, you know, all the vampires are ambisexual. You know, they have sex with men and women. Doesn't, you know, the you live that long and it doesn't matter to you, you know.
Party time.
So I had to figure out a reason why he only preys on women. And I took as inspiration certain predators. Like, we've all seen a cat play with a mouse, right? And I know from the from you guys, the sequence of orcas you did with SeaWorld, that Ed, you were the host on that one.
Yeah.
The orcas can toss a seal around in the air for an hour, you know? Well, why do they do this, you know? And certain animal behavioralists will say, well, they're honing their skills. And I'm like, really? Yeah. They already caught the thing. How's this honing the skills?
Yeah.
And my thought was always, maybe this just makes it taste better.
Oh, like tenderizing.
Maybe somehow the fear juices are marinating that meat and it just tastes better, you know? So Dracula goes on and on about how women just taste better. Yeah. You know, like he says there's a certain assertive tang in the gore of males.
See, that's the thing I love. Stuff I've not thought of. And when he said that, I went, that really helps me draw this.
Yeah.
You know, that does, because then I see him being more, rather than seductive, more culinary.
Consumptive.
Yeah, he's culinary about it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
If I had to eat a person, I'd choose a woman.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. When I remember telling my wife about that, she goes, that's exactly what would, I mean, there's so many things Matt does. I always run it by her and I'll say, well, okay, what would you react to? And she goes, no, that's good. That's good. And it's all horrible things happening to women. So she'll go, no, that's scary. That,
you know, if it's passed, that, if it passes your artist's wife test,
yeah,
you're good.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'll always say it like, well, would this bug you? And she goes, no, that's really good. Don't change that. And I'm like going, okay, that's good.
In book three, when he's in London, I have him describe the taste of everybody he bites.
Oh, I love and it,
in most cases it has to do with their social status. Like, I remember one is, she tasted of liniment and broken dreams.
Yeah.
And, you know, it varies from whether it's a man or a woman or high class or low class, you know.
Yeah.
And so when you're writing something like this, like something like Dracula that's been done so many times, and I'm sure you've seen basically every Dracula adaptation out there and probably read quite a few of them as well. Like, how do you kind of keep the ideas of other people out of your head?
That's tough. And I do stay away from certain things. Like when we started this, I deliberately did not go check out Marv Wolfman and Gene Colan's long running classic run at Marvel Comics, Tomb of Dracula, which is where Blade was first introduced. That was so much material. I thought, well, I don't want to cross over with something they might have done consciously. If I do it accidentally, fine. Deliberately stayed away from those. Yeah.
I love reading those too. So when I got on this, I just took all those books I used to love and put them away. When I was doing Batman, I wouldn't read Batman comics from the artists I love. Yeah. I mean, I went on a 10-year not reading it. It was because you don't want to be influenced by it or take the same ground. If, you know, consciously or unconsciously, you try not to.
And speaking of crossover material, I don't know if you guys know this or not. Have either of you ever seen the Dan Curtis directed 70s TV movie starring Jack Palance?
No.
Of
Did
Dracula.
Not know that
it's,
existed.
It's adapted by Richard Matheson, by the legendary fucking Richard Matheson.
Twilight Zone Richard Matheson?
It's pretty darn good.
I think it's an excellent.
It's where they first introduced the theory that Mina is the reincarnation of his long-lost love.
Yeah, it's excellent.
That was on when they were developing Tomb of Dracula, and so artist Gene Colan based his Dracula on Jack Palance.
Yes, and he did a great job of it.
It gave him a little mustache, but if you go and look, it's got like this broad face and a broad mouth like Jack Palance, and the eyes kind of beady. And
he's mean as shit in that, too.
Yeah, he is mean as shit. Yeah.
Now, is there any like Dracula lore you're like, fuck it, that's stupid? Like, I didn't see anything about garlic in the first book or anything.
We get to garlic. Yeah. I mean, he's so powerful. I have that most of it doesn't affect him all that much.
Yeah.
It's also, you know, the whole thing with the Scholomance. First of all, in the novel, we don't see many other vampires, and they're all women. But he exhibits powers way beyond what the other ones have. You can see them. Mainly what they do is they can turn into a mist and materialize here and there. But you never see them command the weather or transform into animals or command animals, you know? And I, my approach was, that's all shit. That's all necromancy that he learned at the Scholomance, you know? That's outside of vampiric powers. We do bring in garlic in the third one. Crosses and stuff, though. Like, there's a famous... it's actually a pretty good movie, but it has a silly fucking ending. It's Hammer's second film called Brides of Dracula. Mm-hmm. Did not star Christopher Lee. Christopher Lee didn't come back for that one. And it's got a lot of good stuff in it.
It does.
But at the very end, they turn a windmill so that the arms of the windmill are a cross. And he gets kind of like fucked up by the cross. Now, that doesn't make any sense because there are crosses in architecture everywhere you look, you know. Yeah. Picket fences are full of crosses. You know, he wouldn't be able to go anywhere. So my approach is it has to be wielded with a faith behind it, an active faith too, not a cursory or a casual faith, you know, to have an effect on him.
Oh, so if you're an atheist and show Dracula a cross, it don't
ain't gonna
shit.
Do shit, buddy. Yep.
Hell yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
I think he would be the best. Dracula did exist. You'd fill churches. Yeah. Because you'd go, man, I don't know. I just want to go to the store at night, so I got
it. Well, on the, you know, we're here on the subject of monsters, and Kelly, like, this isn't the first of, like, the massive, like, monsters, the universal monsters that you worked on. Like, Frankenstein Alive,
yeah,
I adore. It is absolutely incredible. But you took over and did the last issue and took over from, like, the legendary Bernie Wrightson, the guy who co-created Swamp Thing. Like, what was it like to work on something like that?
It was as big of an honor as you could get. He called me, and as soon as he asked me, I knew bad things were going on in his life.
Yeah.
You know? And
it was ill health, right? He was kind of towards the end of his life.
He had reached a point where obviously his doctors had said they've done all they could do, and he wanted it completed. And he had penciled very little. Most of it was on little thumbnails about this big, almost a little bigger than a postage stamp, where he would just kind of indicate what he wanted, but he would write it down. He would write what the quotes were, and he gave he had all the stuff sent in his preparation for it, but it was, like I said, a tremendous honor and terribly sad at the same time. That same year I do that and he passes. So did Len Wein, who I'd been doing Swamp Thing with.
Yeah.
And you know, as an 11-year-old, when I first found their books, 11 or 12, however old I was, those things had never figured. I'd never figured that. And the fact, with Wrightson's Frankenstein, he had a few beautiful penciled pages. And I said, I don't want to ink those. I'll trace them, whatever. And, because I wanted the originals to stay him
intact. Yeah.
Yes. But they were gorgeous. Absolutely as good as you can imagine. So at that point, you know, like I said, it was very, very sad to do, but I'm glad I did it because it finished out his book. And I made a point that, so people would really know, I didn't let them publish it in grayscale, but in color scale. So you could see all my work lines. So you'd know it's okay. Now it's me. It's not him. Just out of respect. I don't know how he did it, but he did it.
And that's funny you should mention those small layouts. That's I do that tiny sometimes, and I give advice
they
like
were
that.
So small,
I know, but I a little bit bigger than that. I give advice to young wannabes. I say, do your layouts this big, because if you can make it clear that size, then the rest is all just dressing. You know,
he did, and if something was more complex, his compositions would. Yeah, that's what you really writes in. If anything was composition, so. And he would indicate where the light sources were. So I just went with that. But that was a tough draw, but I was very happy with it while doing it because he had passed at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was nowhere to go for a question or something. I was glad that they sent me a few things he had done and it was finished. So I could see how he pushed or pulled a line, how he applied washes and stuff. And that was extremely instructive. There's no way to do it. I mean, it was that good. And he drew so much with the brush. It was exhilarating to see that. You could tell that wasn't drawn. He just went and did it.
Yeah.
Yeah. You see that in from his early career, there's a bunch of large pieces that he had penciled and then started to ink and quit for whatever reason halfway through. So you really get to see those stages and how much, as you said, yes, he's rendering in the actual brush.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Which takes a mastery and a confidence that is supreme.
He could just sit down and draw. He didn't really, I mean, I looked at some of this stuff and I go, there's no real, I know he would do preliminaries, but there's not a lot of sketching.
Pretty brief, yeah.
Yeah, you just draw. Yeah, it was just mm-hmm. all there.
Structural shapes, and that's about it.
I'm big on composition myself, but it was a clinic.
Yeah. So is that when you're drawing like two different types of like it seems like with Frankenstein, there's like more of a slow pace, but Dracula far more manic. Like, yeah. Does that sort of change like the way that like do you when you're drawing something more manic, do you draw faster or slower?
I do. There's days.
I do too. Yep.
There's days. I think you said he's very angry and he's very emotional. Dracula is the third one. He has to be a little more reserved because he's in public now. But,
well, and he's in an alien environment, so he doesn't know anything about. Yeah.
But when he lets himself go, it does work on me. I do find myself, you do draw faster. Dracula, I don't have any trouble figuring out what I want to do.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it is that Matt's scripts are pretty clear on what he wants, but he's also pretty clear on the intent. So...
And you just make him so sinister in every fucking shot. Yeah. Like, no matter what he's doing, I was like, yeah, that guy looks sinister as shit.
But it's good. It's more of a hiss than a bleh. It's different.
Yep.
Well, he's in charge. I always see it like he's got all this ability. He's got to be cautious in certain ways, but he's clearly the alpha of whatever.
Of whatever setting he's in. Yeah. Yep.
Well, guys, thank y'all so much for joining us today. This has been such a pleasure.
Yeah.
Real quick before we go, Marcus, we'd be remiss if we don't mention our project.
God damn. Well, if it ever
fucking comes out.
Yeah, me and Matt worked on a project. I wrote a 21-page, 22-page Sid and Nancy retelling of the Sid and Nancy story. Matt drew it. It was a goddamn absolute pleasure to work on.
And it all came about because my son, Brennan, turned me on to Last Pod.
Yeah.
And from there, I discovered No Dogs.
Yeah.
And so I wrote them a note and I was like, you guys, your show, that was the soundtrack of my entire career. And Marcus came back and said, hey, well, I'm writing a story about that kind of music. Would you be interested in drawing it, you know?
I mean, my God, it was just so cool.
It was totally fun, yeah.
To work with
you. And Marcus,
you're
in a very small club, dude, because I've almost never worked with other writers.
I know. Oh, that's awesome. It's absolutely incredible. But yes, thank you so much.
You guys had Kevin Smith on a month or so ago, something like that, right?
Yeah.
Andrew Kevin's very first comic book story.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah. It was a Jay and Silent Bob short story called Walt Flanagan's Dog, where they get in these misadventures and they end up like having a run in with this little yappy dog. So they get the dog stoned. And then when they kind of come out of their daze, the dog's laying there with this enormous fucking heart on.
Yeah. I read it. I remember.
Yeah. And I later designed the first Jay and Silent Bob action figures. And we included the dog as one of the accessories. And we named him Tripod because he's standing on his front two legs and his dick. And then, his little hind legs are just kind of like waving around behind me.
But yeah, I mean, hopefully, you know, once our next Z2 book comes out, we're still working on that right now, when exactly that will come out. But once that does come out, then yeah, it's, you know, it's, you know, me writing and Matt drawing the full Sid and Nancy story and every bit.
And
of,
my son coloring. Brennan
yeah,
coloring.
And Brennan coloring as well. Like it's so, and it's gory as hell. Yeah. It's just as gory as the
Brennan
story
said to me,
is.
Dad, this is one of the most extreme things you've ever done. I was like, well.
I was very proud. That actually makes me very proud that I wrote one of the most extreme things
rock,
that Matt Wagner's ever done.
I didn't even know this existed. I can't wait to read it. It must have been fun to draw all those needles.
Yeah.
It was, you know,
a lot of needles and a lot of knives.
A lot of decrepit shit. Yeah, a lot of, you know, that scene was pretty gnarly, as Marcus accurately described, you know, so it was...
Thank you. I can't wait for people to see it, but it'll be out at some point when, you know, that whole thing gets released.
Wow. More Gary
and
Oldman.
And before we split, everybody, the campaign for the new one launches Wednesday, October 1st. Go to Kickstarter, Dracula, Book 3, The Count.
Yes. Nice.
And you can still get Books 1 and 2. You can still get the hardcovers of Books 1 and 2.
And people can get the hardcovers for Books 1 and 2 from the Kickstarter?
Yes.
All right.
Okay.
Yep. They'll be offered on this one as well. Yep.
Yeah. And are these for sale in bookstores and comic book stores? Can they order them from their...
The Kickstarter is the only place to get the hardcovers. Then okay. Dark Horse Comics releases the trade paperback version via regular retail outlets about a month after the backers get their hardcover editions.
All right. Cool. So, you can either
and we have extra rewards. We actually have some original art this time that's a collaboration between me and Kelly. 10 original pieces.
Cool.
So
that's kickstarter.com/...
Again, if you just search on Kickstarter for Dracula, Matt Wagner, Kelly Jones, you'll find it.
Got it. Yeah. Or, of course, you know, ask your local comic book store to order it for you if you can.
Yeah. Yep. Make sure you read this. It's really cool. It's like history meets Dracula. I don't know. It's just badass. I love it.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.
Yeah. I've volumes 1 and 2. I love so much and read through the whole things in one night.
It's a lot of work.
So much
boy,
fun.
It's a ton of fun, as you can tell from the way we enthuse about it.
Yeah. Well, thank y'all so much.
You bet. Thanks for having us, guys.
Thanks.